I'd like to welcome you to the Migration Policy Institute. My name is Kathleen Newland, and I direct the Migrants, Migration, and Development Program here at MPI. And we're really delighted to have you here today, where we are launching a new book called Diasporas, New Partners in Global Development Policy. And that, of course, is going to be the topic of our discussions today. We are going to be recording the proceedings and posting them on our website with a bit of editing, which I'll explain shortly. The book, as you know, is the product of a partnership with USAID, and we were happy to be able to match their grant to MPI thanks to the generosity of the MacArthur Foundation, which has been a major supporter of our migration and development work. I'm delighted to have three distinguished colleagues from the U.S. government who are really leading the U.S. government's work and developing the interest in the U.S. government on diaspora engagement. And they will speak in the order in which I'm going to introduce them just now. Karen Turner is a career minister at USAID. That may not be a familiar title to you. It's the highest rank that a foreign service officer can obtain in USAID, so there are not very many of them. And Karen is the director of the Office of Development Partners in USAID. She, as you may have noted, wrote the foreword to the book, and she has been a staunch advocate for involving diasporas more in the work of USAID, has been quick to recognize that diasporas have a great deal to contribute, both in terms of knowledge and talent and commitment to development in their countries of origin. I'm going to come back to you after Karen has said a few words to tell you a little bit about the book. Not a great deal, because, of course, I want you all to go home and read it immediately, but hopefully just enough to pique your curiosity. We're then going to have Pradeep Ramamurthy, who is the Senior Director of Global Engagement on the National Security Staff at the White House. He is speaking on background today, therefore we're not going to post his comments. This is not because he's going to say anything top secret, I don't believe, but rather because if he had to have everything cleared by the White House, that would have ruled out any spontaneity in our discussion later on. So we're grateful to him for being willing to comment on this topic and tell us something about the interest in this topic, which goes to the very top of the U.S. government, as those of you who listened to the President's speech in Cairo earlier this year will know. And finally, we'll have Thomas DeBas, who is the newly appointed Regional Director at the Global Partnership Initiative in the State Department. Thomas is the godfather of this christening. He, before going over to the State Department, and with the intervening few months at the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, was at USAID in Karen's office and developed the Diaspora Networks Alliance framework, and that DNA framework is very much the sort of template for this book. The book is a collection of many authors, and I want to introduce one of them, Aaron Terrazas. Aaron, please stand up, who is a policy analyst here at MPI and wrote a couple of the chapters and contributed to others. We also had the very talented interns on this project, and a couple of them contributed so much that they earned authorship as well. And one of them is here, Roberto Munster, who helped us with the chapter on diaspora philanthropy. Our counterpart in USAID, Yvonne Resplendy, is at the back of the room, and Yvonne was with us almost throughout the process. He was appointed as Tomas left, and was a very committed partner in the series of roundtables that we had around each of the chapters of the book. And I'm not sure if any of our colleagues from QED, which managed the grant, are here, but they were also very important in keeping the whole process on track. We owe a particular debt to a great many practitioners, diaspora leaders, entrepreneurs, philanthropists, and others who participated in the series of roundtables we had here at MPI. They vetted the drafts of these chapters. They gave us lots of good ideas. A few of those people are in the room, and I really would like to thank them for all they contributed to the process. As I said, I'll come back with a little bit more to say about the book, book's contents shortly. But first, I'd like to turn over to Karen Turner, and thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, and I really would like to express my compliments to Kathleen for the leadership that she has exercised and the work that the Migration Policy Institute did and the studies that are reflected in the book. These studies really are obviously very thoughtful and well-grounded, and will provide a very valuable contribution to the dialogue on development. But before I go on and give my remarks, I really would like to say a little bit about this gentleman here to my right, because even though Kathleen referenced Tomas, I really cannot say enough about the role that Tomas played within USAID in pioneering our work on diaspora and of being a lone voice that was really pushing this agenda long before it was really sort of picked up more widely. And so our diaspora agenda within USAID and a lot of the conversation and framework through which we speak is really due to this gentleman here, and so I really wanted to take the opportunity to acknowledge that. So, you know, our hope is, with regard to the studies that you see reflected here, is that they will stimulate discussion here in the U.S., in other donor countries, and more importantly, actually, in the developing countries, and that our partner countries really can give thought to how they can nurture and benefit from the abiding interest that the diaspora have in their country of origin and the potential for that interest really to be extended to multiple generations. So why was USAID interested in this focus on the diaspora, and kind of what are we doing about it? First of all, the total migrant population in the U.S. is somewhere in excess of 40 million, and clearly is becoming a force, not only politically but otherwise in the U.S. itself, but also in their countries of origin. But engaging the diaspora has not been a systematic aspect of USAID's development practice. USAID's commissioning, however, of these studies is a reflection of an understanding, an increasing understanding of the role of the diaspora in the work that we do, and that it is important, and that we want our actions and our activities in this space to be motivated by more than just a feeling that the diaspora is important. The papers really sort of provide that thoughtful analysis that indicate the ways in which the diaspora is important. Also, often when there are discussions about the diaspora, the principal and sometimes even the sole focus is on remittances. But clearly, as the studies demonstrate, diaspora roles are far broader and far more significant than just remittances. And so the studies that MPI has led is really contributing to our understanding of the diaspora and their roles in a more comprehensive manner, and how development agencies such as USAID can, through conscious choices, leverage the roles and actions of the diaspora. So at USAID, we ourselves plan to use the studies, and our intention is to use the studies to help us make the engagement and partnering with the diaspora a much more intentional feature of USAID's development practice. And this is really also, I think, in the context of our work to help developing countries use all the tools at their disposal, our collective disposal, to affect sustainable broad-based development. So we see the studies as not only important for USAID, but in working with our developing country partners to help them see how engaging the diaspora can be significant for them as well. We believe that if we understand and can understand the work and the motivations and interests of the diaspora better, that it can enhance the opportunities we have to leverage those efforts. Clearly, we all know that the diaspora, that they are already doing a lot in their countries of origin. And so this really, the conversation we're having to look at the diaspora is not to suggest that these individuals and their organizations are not already a significant force in their countries of origin. But we think that there are opportunities to leverage that interest and to support their interest and to help them and their countries of origin through more intentional collaboration and consideration to have even a greater impact in their countries of origin. And also that if we can better understand their motivations and how they can be best mobilized, that we can help enhance the role that they're playing in their country's origin. Recently, together with colleagues here, including Kathleen, I participated in the Global Forum on Migration and Development. Most of the conversations, although it was a conference on migration and development, most of the conversations really were around migration and not necessarily around development. But what we saw there in understanding and participating in the conversations about migration was really recognizing the significance of the role that diasporas play in their countries of origin and in their countries of destination. And one of the things, for example, that USAID is going to be doing in follow-up is our Swiss colleagues. So Switzerland is hosting the next forum. And they've asked us to work with them on really bringing out more of the development part of that conversation and looking at migration and development. And we think that one of the areas of content that will help us engage with the Swiss and bring out more of that development conversation, which we think is a conversation and part about the diaspora, we think the studies will help us be able to inform that look at migration and development and actually really talk about development as a part of that conversation. We also look forward to collaborating with other donors that are interested in diaspora engagement in order to share our experiences, lessons learned, and best practices, as well as to explore opportunities for how we might be able to enhance the impact in developing countries by virtue of how we work in a coordinated manner with diaspora that may be located in different countries. So going forward, AID is really, as I said, looking to enhance the way in which we look at the issue of diasporas in the context of our development practice. We now have two staff persons, Yvonne Masblundi and Romy Bhatia, that are, I think, back there somewhere, that we now have on board, whose principal responsibilities are to focus on diaspora issues, including public-private partnerships that are grounded in engaging the diaspora. And unlike when we had my colleague here, when we really did not have resources that we were particularly mobilizing against, this is an area in which we do will be mobilizing resources to look at ways in which we can best engage diaspora. We've established an agency working group that is focused on the diaspora. It represents, it has representations from all the operational parts of USAID. We have an action plan that has been approved by the USAID administrator and an agenda of actions that we intend to pursue in order to bring increased attention to our colleagues within the agency about the diaspora. One of our initial actions that we're working on is a plan to convene a series of brown bags within the agency that will take a look at the individual topics that are a part of this book that MPI, the MPI studies, with a view to, first of all, increasing people's awareness of the analysis and really the understanding the role of the diaspora, to foster increased interest in identifying in what context diaspora are important, and also looking for and encouraging opportunities to partner with diaspora. We also will be, as an agency, proactively engaging diasporas in the U.S. Through our legislative and public affairs part of USAID, bringing them information about the programs that USAID has in their countries of origin, soliciting input, and as well as creating awareness of opportunities to compete for funding within USAID that enables them to get engaged in development in a more specific way. So in closing, let me just say we really look forward to the conversations that we hope will be engendered by the studies that are in the collected in the MPI published book. And we look forward, even more importantly, to seeing what kind of actions result from some of the analysis that is reflected here. And we ourselves will be looking at the kinds of things that we can do to bring greater attention to the role that diasporas play in the in development, and how we, working with partner countries, can partner to maximize the impact that they can have in development. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for those really those very kind words. It's really gratifying to see in these last few years that the interest in the roles that diasporas play in their countries of origin is proliferating. We see this growing interest in donor agencies, in investment groups, in philanthropic circles, and above all, in diaspora communities themselves. Just as remittances sort of shot into public view about 6 or 7 years ago, the exploration of different forms of diaspora engagement beyond remittances is really a growth industry now. We at MPI are very pleased that USAID encouraged us and supported us to look more deeply into six specific forms of diaspora engagement, which are presented in this book, along with some overarching analysis that spans all six areas, and a strategic roadmap for diaspora engagement, which you'll see on page 16. Each chapter also contains a set of policy options that we concluded could strengthen the impact of diaspora actions and partnerships in each of the six areas. There's a huge and growing volume of academic literature on diasporas,
but it hasn't penetrated very far into the policy world. We set about trying to fill this gap, both by drawing on the academic studies and by engaging in an intensive series of consultations with policymakers and practitioners from both governmental and private sector institutions. And I'm pleased to see quite a few of those people in the room here today, and thank them again for very generously sharing their insights with us. Diaspora engagement is a fact. It's happening even in the absence of policy intervention or policy response. And it's both a reflection and, to some extent, a causal factor in globalization. It's simply easier for members of diaspora to stay involved in their countries of origin, both personally and in their professional lives. That's particularly true for the growing number of people around the world who have dual citizenship, another reflection of globalization, the globalization of marriage in particular, and the fact that people are able to travel so easily back and forth makes it possible for them to run businesses in a country other than the country in which they live, to make charitable contributions and sort of keep up, at least to some extent, with how those contributions are used. With all of these roles, however, and the overlap in those roles with the priorities of donors like the U.S. Agency for International Development, I still think it's important for policymakers in both the countries of origin and countries of destination to realize that diasporas aren't instruments, that they can't just be sort of used instrumentally. They have their own agendas, their own priorities, their own goals. But having said that, there is so often a great deal of common ground among the priorities and interests of donors of countries of origin, government of country of destination governments, and diaspora groups, that there is plenty of work to be done in that intersection. But diasporas do expect engagement to be a two-way street when they engage with governments, the governments of their ancestral countries, who sometimes diasporas feel just sort of look at them as cash cows or as sources of, if not financial resources, then skills and talents and so on, but have not yet come to grips with the problem of why should diasporas engage other than just out of sentiment and loyalty. And I think that is something that governments of countries of origin need to think about quite hard, not only the motivations, but how to ease the way for diaspora entrepreneurs, for diaspora investors, philanthropists, volunteers, and so on. There are many steps that can be taken to facilitate engagement. From the point of view of the country of destination governments, I think we have to be prepared to try to answer the question, why? You know, what's the added value in working with diaspora groups? It's not easy. It's often very challenging. You have to worry about the appearance of favoritism among the great array of diaspora groups there are, about factionalism, about hidden agendas or not so hidden agendas that may not coincide with the agendas of the U.S. government. And you always have to worry about representativeness, you know, who speaks for whom in the world of diasporas. So it's not easy, but it is, I think we became firmly convinced in doing this work, it is rewarding, it is worthwhile to make the effort to engage. Diaspora groups have a wealth of knowledge about their countries of origin that they understand very often the language, but certainly the culture, the ways of doing business, and the the social relations that frame every kind of interaction. Many diaspora groups are well-funded and highly skilled in pursuing their agendas and very experienced. Others have a lot more enthusiasm than capacity. And I think this is one place where interaction with governments can be mutually beneficial. Many active members of diaspora groups have day jobs. The groups operate on shoestring budgets or sometimes no budgets at all with volunteer staff and donated premises, and people are sort of struggling to establish themselves in the countries where they have settled. So I think there is a tremendous potential role for donors in strengthening the capacity of diaspora groups in helping them with, you know, with technical assistance, with training, with trying to find funding, and so on, so that they really develop the capacity to be real partners in development and in thinking through development policy. But I think there's also a task, an important role for donors to strengthen the capacity of the governments of countries of origin to engage with diaspora groups. We've tracked in one of our earlier books, which you may have seen outside, we've tracked the number of institutions that governments in countries of origin have been setting up to engage with their diaspora groups. And while some of them, like the State of Israel, like Senegal, Italy, Ireland, have long since had government institutions whose purpose is to engage with the diaspora, many of these institutions are new. They're diaspora ministries, probably in 30 or 40 countries now, lots of sub-ministries and special offices and so on. But a lot of them are desperately underfunded, understaffed, and have very little experience. So I think there is a lot of scope for cooperation from donors in trying to boost the ability of countries of origin to engage more effectively with the diasporas. That's not just a role for government donors. Also, and one of the very interesting things that that we've seen developing is sort of country of origin to country of origin assistance. We just met with a colleague from Ethiopia that said that the government of Ethiopia has been getting technical assistance from the government of India on diaspora engagement. They have worked hard on a sort of model set of institutions and practices that they feel can be useful to other governments, at least as a starting point. Many of the institutions of the Jewish diaspora have worked with other diaspora groups to share their experience of how to be effective advocates. So there is a lot going on at the sort of diaspora to diaspora level, country of origin to country of origin, as well as the more familiar donor relations. Another very important area, I think, for cooperation on diaspora engagement is on building up a knowledge base and knowledge management. It's one of the things that we hear most from governments is, how do we find out where our diaspora is? We don't know where they live. We don't know, you know, who they are, what they do. We don't know what they need, what they have to contribute. And so I think this is something where the universities and think tanks among us, as well as government institutions, can help in mapping diasporas, and helping both fund and carry out skills inventories, and all manner of sort of communications efforts, so that the governments of diasporas get to know each other and can really.
establish that two-way street. I'm not going to go into much detail about the chapters. As you know, if you look at the table of contents, the six areas that we looked at were diaspora entrepreneurship, diaspora investment in capital markets, so that's the sort of direct and indirect investment, right, by diasporas. A chapter that was, to me, very interested on diaspora involvement in heritage tourism and nostalgia trade, that is, tourism that is attached to the sort of history and culture of the country of origin and is interesting to lots of tourists, but to members of the diaspora in particular, and to trade in items that are both produced in and somehow sort of reflective of the culture of the country of origin. Love of food, which I can understand very well, but this sort of particular diaspora-focused forms of tourism and trade were very interesting to look at, where diasporas often serve as sort of first movers into new markets and can establish those markets for non-diaspora populations as well. A classic example being salsa, which outsells ketchup in the United States now. unfortunately, I think now most of it is made in the United States as well, but that's one of the challenges in nostalgia trade, is to retain the sort of national branding of both products and of particular kinds of tourism. We looked at diaspora philanthropy as the role of immigrants and their descendants, both as charitable donors, but also as social innovators and agents of change through philanthropy. And closely related to that, to diaspora volunteerism. We see an increasing number of members of the diaspora returning to their countries of origin to contribute their skills, their talents, their organizational abilities, and a form of engagement that is very much welcomed by the countries of origin, not only for what diasporas bring as volunteers, but also because the experience of being a volunteer very often really consolidates the relationship of a member of a diaspora to the country of origin. And indeed, some countries have started sponsoring sort of birthright tourism or sort of peak experiences for members of the diaspora to really grow their sense of attachment to the country. And finally, we looked at diaspora advocacy, addressing how diaspora communities attempt to influence policy both in their countries of origin and in their countries of destination. And we tried to look at some of the factors that make some diaspora communities much more successful at that than others, based on their skills, their unity, their focus, their commitment, and their ability to present a sort of coherent advocacy agenda. So there's a wealth of observation in these chapters. It was a privilege and even fun to look at these topics, and I'm very heartened to hear Karen say that there's much more to come in terms of where you go with these observations, and I hope that that other governments and particularly other that diaspora groups will find this information useful and will help us as we try to take it on to the next step.
Thomas.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. First, I just want to say thank you for the kind words, Taryn. And I want to kind of push back in terms of the kudos that I'm getting, because when you're in a race in any, whether in a game, no one gives you props for starting it. It's for the ones who finish it. And I did indeed start it and imagined it, but I didn't finish it. So for those like Yvonne, Rockefeller, Reese, Renee, Stacey Young, everyone, Karen's team, who drank my Kool-Aid and liked it, and but finished it all. I think all the credit goes to them and me. And the other thing that I want to give credit to was the United flight that I took to Ghana, where this idea come from. It was that United flight napkin. And I wrote this DNA thing that flight boredom gives you ideas. And this book is essentially the substance to that two-page that I put together that everyone was asking me. They liked this DNA framework, actually the picture. But I didn't have much substance behind it. And I came to Kathleen and asked her for substance. And this is what this is. So I just wanted to make sure that I put that across. And I recently joined the Global Partnership Initiative in the Office of the Secretary of State, who is mandated to engage the diaspora. The Secretary has had a number one priority for this initiative is the diaspora engagement. The beauty of speaking at the end of that, I don't have much to say because they've covered it all. But we all are in the same coin. I totally regard what USAID is doing on the DNA framework as what I work on. We're two sides of the same coin. What my task is to look for intersection between foreign policy and development. In that endeavor, the lens that I look at is purely on partnerships. What kind of partnerships can we create with the diaspora? Working with obviously USAID, Pradeep, and other government agencies as a USG entity from a foreign policy point of view. And since the office sits in the Secretary's office, that having that kind of stature, and my ambition in that office is essentially to elevate diaspora to be the first D. You've heard of the 3Ds: diplomacy, development, and defense. And luckily, the word diaspora starts with D. So it's easier to make it that way. So that's essentially the task that we have. How important is the diaspora for foreign policy formulation, for foreign assistance, for development, and what have you? And we'll be looking at different ways of engagement, working intimately as a team, and advancing that. One of the first tasks that we have is, as Pradeep mentioned, the Secretary, back in last March, announced that she is going to host a global diaspora forum at State Department this year. Because of the delay for my arrival, we pushed it for 2011. So hopefully in spring, the first of its kind global diaspora forum will be hosted by the Secretary at State Department. We're going to be working on that holistically. One of the things I want to comment, and I don't have much to say because everybody has said it all, and you should read the book, and the book will be able to tell you why we're doing this, why this is important for USAID, why it's important for NSC, why it's important for State Department. But I want to kind of talk very briefly about a concept in my head called diaspora consensus. It might sound an oxymoron because there isn't much consensus around diaspora communities. It's quite fragmented in the way they think, in their views in terms of what should be done in their home countries, what have you. But could there be an effort to have a consensus around what internal, diaspora type of engagements that can happen that would help us, bigger agencies like AID and State Department and what have you, to engage with, because it's very difficult to engage with communities that are fragmented. Because when you don't have a consensus, how could you be sitting in the same table to have that? So one of the things that what I'm hoping to challenge these communities is to have a consensus, to dare to have a consensus, to say what are the areas that we have common understanding to work together, whether it's in foreign policy formulation or development assistance that happens in countries, that could help us and achieve what we need to do. So that's essentially what I want to say, and I don't want to be redundant to what, and I'll leave it to questions to move from that.
Thank you very much, Thomas. I think that that's further evidence of the proliferation of interest in diasporas that's being taken up by the State Department and what will be a very public transparent. So we have just about 20 minutes left for discussion, and welcome your comments, your questions to our speakers. And please identify yourself as you ask your question.
Hi, this is Sarah Williamson with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, and my question is for Ms. Turner with USAID. And I'm wondering if you could give us some specific examples, recent examples, where the diaspora community has been helpful. And I'm thinking particularly of Haiti and Sudan coming up, where there have been major critical events in countries of interest.
During Haiti in particular, I can speak personally from that because my office, Office of Development Partners, played a role in reaching out to various external actors to engage them on their interests. So in the case of diaspora, in the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake, there really were various constituent parts of the diaspora that came and interacted with USAID to discuss ways in which they were interested in helping. But I'd like to reference something that was said earlier about the complexity of the diaspora, because there is a complexity to the diaspora. There's various, even within a particular country's diaspora, there's various groups that you have to work with. They may not share all the same political views and so forth, and in addition, they may not necessarily be sort of organized in ways in which may be most efficient to work. So, but in the aftermath of Haiti, there were just a tremendous outpouring of volunteer of Haitian American professionals, physicians, nurses, every imaginable area that were interested in helping. And one of the areas in which USAID worked with professional associations that comprised of Haitian Americans was to assist them in interfacing with the sort of the relief structure, which was the UN structure there, and to get programmed into being able to utilize their services, to rotate people in, to facilitate getting transport for individuals in. So in the aftermath of Haiti, there really was a tremendous amount of interaction with the Haitian diaspora. There was a lot that was led out of the White House. And I would say some of the most prominent areas of collaboration and support was around facilitating the large numbers of Haitian American volunteers which were interested in helping in a whole host of things.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that the Haiti earthquake example is in some ways a very representative one, because I've noticed that it's natural disasters seem to be a tremendous catalyst for diaspora populations.
Yes.
That it often, you know, really brings them together, you know, sort of overcomes the factionalism for a while, and at least for a while. Maybe not more than 24 hours, but at least for a while. And even motivates some diaspora communities that have been very alienated from their countries of origin to sort of get involved again. I'm thinking of the Banff earthquake in Iran, where the Iranian diaspora community here, which is mostly, you know, very anti-different government in Iran, nonetheless gave a lot of money for humanitarian relief after.
And
lots of fans. We'll sort of go this way. You can go.
My name's Terence. My name is Heran Sarek Abrahan. I'm here from the Ethiopian Community Development Council in Virginia. My question has to do with, could you say a little bit about how the how developing countries' governments deal with these diasporas? Because that by itself is also a very complex thing. And do they open them, you know, sort of welcome them with open arms, or is it, you know, yeah, we want your money, but not your politics and criticism? That's what I sense, but
it's a very good.
There's a whole book about this. Yeah.
It's a very good question, and it's impossible to generalize because almost anything you could describe you find in some government or another. Certainly, the "we want your money, but we don't want your opinion" is a pretty frequent observation. But I think there, you know, there are plenty of others who really have realized that the diaspora has a lot to offer, and not just money. I think partly from observing the experience of countries like the development of the software industry in India, where, you know, diaspora has played a significant role, I think one that may sometimes be overstated, but a significant role, and want to sort of get that kind of economic boost, and realize that, you know, in order to develop partnerships, it, you really have to be a partner, it's not just a top-down thing. I mean, India did a tremendous amount of research into its diaspora. They had a 2-year effort to find out where they were, to talk to them, to ask the investors, why aren't you investing in India? And appeared to hear them say, are you crazy? Do you know what is involved to set up a business in India from abroad? You have to get 178 licenses, and it takes 3.5 years or whatever. So they changed, you know, and that was really set up a one-stop shop for diaspora investors. And I think it's that kind of, it's one of the reasons why one of the big steps in the roadmap here is listening exercises. You know, the governments really have to listen to their diasporas and find out what their interests are, what their priorities are, what their goals are, not just what the government wants them to do. So you have, you know, a pretty large range, and you have some, I think, some instances where the tail wags the dog a bit. You know, you have big, powerful diasporas and relatively small, poor countries where the diaspora has a tremendous influence, often really beyond what the government would like. I mean, for a time, Armenia had dual citizenship, and then it revoked it, you know, because they were so concerned about the overweening influence, political influence of people who would not have to live with the results of their votes on a daily basis. So it's a very good question. It's a very interesting question, and there are some indications.
Yeah, I think we've also seen that there have been governments that set up departments within their government that is aimed at the diaspora. We've also seen a lot of interest frequently in remittances, and that really is a topic which is obviously a very complex one, because generally the individuals that are behind the remittances are really not interested in that being captured by the government, that potential could be kill the goose or lay the golden egg. So, as Kathleen said, I think that it's really sort of hard to really characterize it across the board because there are dozens. But I think we have seen various ways in which countries do recognize the importance of diaspora. We've seen countries, my familiarity, one of my last overseas posts was Jamaica, so most familiar with there, and that they not only were reaching to the diaspora in the U.S., but they were looking to attract the sort of second and third generation, so they really wanted to keep that relationship alive, and so they were working on programs to attract the youth, so the children of second and third generation, and have programs for them to come back and spend time there during the summers. So we've, I think we've seen I think there's a broad recognition amongst countries that diaspora can be important. Sometimes the organizational effort is benign and simply, trying to facilitate convening. I think where some of the danger lies is when they try to be too controlling, and that frequently can kill off the possibility of really being able to kind of leverage and get the benefit of the diaspora.
Yeah, sure. I think it depends on the countries that you're dealing with. Clearly, I think that when there's a love-love situation is when it involves an economic incentive, when there's a rational behavior behind it, whether it's investment. But when it gets to emotional stuff like politics, that's where it gets dicey. I mean, you're talking about engagement, come to the C Street, entrance of AID. There's probably a diaspora community right now screaming, saying that, that's an engagement in its own. Or go to the White House, there's probably a diaspora community protesting some kind of policy. So it all depends on what engagement are we talking about. If it's about emotional, politics and things like that, obviously there's going to get dicey.
Please, lady in the front. If you don't mind, I'll take a couple of questions at a time.
Hi, my name is Lily Chi, and I'm from Montgomery County Government. I am at the forefront of engaging the diaspora communities within our county, which is now one-third foreign-born, substantial of 1 million people total. So I work primarily with the Asians and Middle Easterns that are not only the people we appreciate to have, but we really need them to be in our community because we are known for biotech and life sciences, and the Indians and Chinese are the best assets we have, basically, in our community. But that said, I would really love to know your perspectives about what United States government's overall attitude is towards diaspora's engagement with their home countries, because I see this as a very dubious issue, meaning if I break it down into two levels, one at local level, where I am, representing the county executive, there is sort of a sentiment among the local community that the foreign-born communities are not integrated or not interested in integration. They can be highly successful. They can live in big mansions in Potomac, but they're still not socially integrated. They're still holding out to their own churches and temples and mosques, whatever. So we would like to see them caring about local issues, showing up at town hall meetings and all that, testifying in public hearings. And that level of engagement we're not seeing, not serving our local boards, committees, or PT. So natural disaster in their home countries, they just flock there. They send money and they get all exercised. So that's local level. At the national level, I wonder if United States government frowns upon diasporas being close to their home countries, because it's hard not to engage the home country government when you go back to do anything in many ways. But that is that looked upon favorably, or is that a reflection of lack of loyalty? Because there are people who grow cold feet, being perceived by the people from their own community as being too close to their home countries. Okay, so it gets political, and there's a lot of division among that, whether you should accept the invitation to your embassy to show up at the 60th anniversary of whatever takeover of, Republic of this and that. It gets very political and divisive within each community, and I'm seeing that at the forefront, so I really want to know what your perspective is on this. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Very, very interesting question. Let's take one more.
I'm Federico Prado. I'm a AAAS fellow. My question is, what would be the ideal level of engagement for a diaspora? Do you have like a goal where you would like to see all diasporas to reach there? And what would be the expectations from them?
This is not a binary issue where you either choose your home, your country of origin or your adopted country. It's actually a lot more complicated than that. For us, in terms of engaging what I call the hyphenated Americans, whatever you come from, you are American first, in a sense. It's not the question of questioning your level of Americanness here. It's the question of if you're engaged in your country, naturally speaking, is there a point of intersection between your engagement in your country and our engagement, USG's engagement in that country? There's no intersection. There's no partnerships. That's as simple as that. So I wouldn't want to look at this from a lens of patriotism or loyalty of where your loyalty stands. It's a question of a natural progression of your engagement and our engagement.
I'd like to ask one of my co-authors, Aaron Terrasas, to just make a brief comment on that as well, about the integration engagement dichotomy.
I think one are successful in participating in their communities back home. So the two really go hand in hand. Just to kind of give one example, there was, you know, in the paper on volunteering, in the chapter on volunteering, we came across the example of one Indian American young woman who had served in Teach for America here in the United States and had kind of really been infused with ideas about education reform and how to improve education systems, and then decided to go spend a year with IndyCorps in India. And after that volunteer experience, decided to go back and work with Teach for India. So kind of this transfer of, you know, these ideas that are, I think, kind of very uniquely ingrained in American society back to her country of ancestry. I mean, she was born in the United States. So I think that's an example of how the two go hand in hand.
I think that's also an important time dimension with integration, you know, that first-generation immigrant communities are very often so focused on establishing themselves and getting their kids moving in the right direction, all that sort of thing, that the community civic engagement comes later. So I think people would have said the same thing about Germans in New York in the 1890s, or Poles in Chicago and the teens. So it'll be interesting to see whether this sort of goes away. On the question of whether there's an ideal level of diaspora engagement, I have to say there really, you know, there isn't. It's so much a matter of individual choice. Even the definition of diaspora is somebody who identifies with and is engaged with their country of origin, or ancestry. So if somebody doesn't want to be, fine. You know, I think there are definitely benefits to be had from a vibrant diaspora community that is engaged. We look at the development side, particularly in the development side from our point of view, but other ways as well. But I couldn't say there's an ideal level. Yes, Lisa.
Hello, my name is Eleanor Brown. I'm on the law faculty at George Washington University, and I'm also Jamaican, and I work on immigration. I just wondered whether or not you felt
a discussion of diaspora engagement in the current case, but broader discussion of trade to that. In other words, an offensive of diaspora engagement are so clear. I put for your ability. Is there a conversation we need to be having to develop a country to see who are the patients has gone at least and start exporting them with a clear idea that we can respond to your mission. So that you're an explicit kind of policy recommending to develop.
Fascinating question. Ned, next to you there.
My name's David Phillips. My question is maybe a little bit subversive. I wanted to know from the panel whether you feel that development assistance and diaspora assistance are mutually exclusive. The reason I ask that is because of the long history of difficulties with the foreign aid programs throughout the world. And whether, in fact, diaspora investment and diaspora financial flows could actually act as a kind of an alternative to development assistance. And if this is the case, what should governments like the U.S. do? Should they, in fact, be pretty much hands-off? In fact, be concentrating much more on things like lowering the cost of remittances and leaving the diaspora largely to find their own way? Thanks.
Well, that is a provocative, if not subversive question. Let's go ahead and take the two questions here, the gentleman in the gray shirt and the young woman in front of him. And I'd like to ask you to be relatively brief.
Yes, okay. Briefly, Jerry Casale, also of Montgomery County, strangely enough, but not representing its government tonight. This is mainly for Mr. Ramamurthy, because You mentioned sort of in passing, I guess, that your office has recognizes there's some sort of a connection between your policy concerns and things like immigration reform, which is always cycling around. I wonder if you could give us any concrete examples of where you think that, you know, interface might be from your office's point of view.
Thank you. Last question.
My name is Judith Forhut, and I'm currently a fellow at USIP. And I've got two brief questions. One is, does it make a difference why people have left their country for the role they play later on, potential role they can play for development? For example, does it make a difference if they have left in the context of civil war or if they had simply economic reasons, whatever? And how could that, you know, play a role in the initiatives for diaspora involvement? And the second one would be, I was just wondering concerning the book, if there is a specific reason why you just focused on developing countries, because you mentioned Italy and many other European countries, and there could be important lessons learned from those cases. And I was wondering if it wouldn't be another interesting thing to look at, or if you maybe have a systematic assumption that, you know, the involvement should be different in developing countries or they can have a different impact there.
Thank you for those questions. If we could have a very quick comment on any one of those that you want to comment on. If we don't have time to get to all of them, I'd like to invite all of you to join us as we break up for a glass of wine and hors d'oeuvres over there, so we can carry on the conversation informally after this round.
So I can do the immigration reform. The point I was making there is only that when it comes to diaspora engagement, there are multiple purposes and multiple issues that are relevant, and immigration reform is clearly something that diaspora communities in the United States care about. That's not an issue that is handled in my office. That's an issue that's handled in the Domestic Policy Council at the White House. But the point is only that when we're engaging diasporas, we should be conscious that they are interested in a broad range of U.S. government policies and issues, and that we are have an interest in their perspective and in working with them on a broad range of issues, and not just development, but a broad range of issues. I think you
there's a couple on just a couple of points on sort of the conscious approach to exporting people as a strategy. One is, even though the Philippines obviously has done a lot of that, I would say that there's a lot of obviously social issues that attach to that, and I think when we're talking about diaspora, it's sort of recognizing in most cases, we're looking at people who've made personal decisions to interact with their country of origin or ancestry, what we as a developing agency really are sort of looking at is that is there an opportunity to attach to that and enable even more to be accomplished because we're sharing aims. I would be loath to suggest as sort of a representative of a development agency that we would want to encourage as a conscious strategy the export of people. I just think there's a lot of social issues, and I think there's a lot of people that are diaspora that probably would have loved to have stayed in their country if they felt the options and benefits were there. In terms of this, the question of development assistance and diaspora assistance being mutually exclusive, again, I guess I would point again to the point that the starting point is that is of individuals that have made personal decisions. So they've made a personal decision that they want to send remittances back to their relatives, that they want to engage in the community that they left, that they're interested in education and so forth. I think we're, as a development agency, we're not looking to replace or substitute. In fact, if through individuals and countries
they're able to foster positive outcomes. The best thing that we as a development agency could do could work ourselves out of a job. I mean, because development really is best done by the people that are there. And so I think what we see our role is really not to say, you know, diaspora-focused development is better or worse. What we're really looking at is there are individuals that have an abiding interest in a particular country. And we, as a development agency, are trying to achieve goals that are very similar to their own. If we can foster and support some of those individuals that have made personal decisions to invest or to lend their human resources, we think that is a real opportunity because it is really those sorts of mechanisms that really make development sustainable than if you have some external entity like us that are really trying to drive it. So I think we really sort of see the role of diaspora and the role of development agencies such as ourselves to be complementary, and because a lot of the the diaspora flows are very personal. I mean, it's going back to a relative or whatever. It's not necessarily the same broad-based development that we as a development agency might be trying to foster. So there are some different features that, you know, if you really sort of look at the characteristics of diaspora-directed development and agencies such as ourselves may be needed to really complement so that you do get development that benefits everyone and not necessarily those that may have a relative that happens to be in a place where they can send resources back.
Let me just compliment what Karen just said. It's the gentleman's question about the full exclusive question. I look at diaspora as a player in development rather than the player, meaning there are multiple players in development. There's the private sector, there are civic societies, there is nonprofits, churches, what have you. I mean, there's this great pie chart that we use that kind of tells us who are, besides ODA, there are multiple players. So you can't look at this lens to say ODA versus development in that kind of lens. What we're saying is there are multiple players in this game. How do we create partnerships with the relevant of their motivations and their incentives to be engaged? What we're looking for, again, is an intersection between these multiple players. And that's the reason, obviously, the diaspora engagement resides in ODP, because there are multiple development partners that could be engaged. The same thing for State Department. We're looking at it completely from a partnerships point of view, where you build partnerships on that basis, not to say we're binary in a sense, we're displacing one for another one. So it's not the formula doesn't work that way.
Because neither the situation in the home country nor the views of the diaspora are static. And so you find, you know, diasporas that in the first generation, like the Vietnamese, are violently opposed to any form of interaction with Vietnam. They don't want the U.S. to establish diplomatic relations. They don't want a free trade agreement. They don't want even humanitarian assistance to go back. Now, very different set of players who are investing in Vietnam. Sometimes it's a generational thing, or sometimes the government in the home country changes, either the government changes or changes its policies. And just very quickly on why we focused on developing countries, it's a good question, and it's to some extent it's an arbitrary decision, except that our focus is on economic development. So we were, you know, focusing on the role of diasporas in developing countries. But we did also discuss examples from middle income and upper income countries: Chile, Mexico, Ireland. We were aware of the value of lessons learned from existing diasporas. Israel, certainly an important one. I think there's a box on the Ireland funds somewhere in the book. So, but maybe that's for the next volume. Anyway, thank you all for extremely interesting questions and for coming.
For more information and to order a copy of Diaspora's New Partners in Global Development Policy, visit www.migrationpolicy.org/store.